CITR Radio would like to remind you that this program is a three-dimensional color presentation. For quality sound and vivid imagery, please use your CITR 3D earplugs.
Hello, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is CITR Doc Season 2. We are broadcasting from UBC, located on top of unceded Coast Salish, Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam land. So, this is the second season of our documentary series, which is about presenting the work of local producers, locally sourced stories. This means that we've got the spectrum from people who are diehard community radio goers to people who are presenting work in an audio medium for the very first time. This week, we've got two pieces from folk who are new at the station, been working with us for a little while. Both of them are UBC students, and they're presenting work on a scale that they have not for the first time. It's always worth mentioning that CITR is a volunteer-run organization, and we're also a training-based organization. So if you're interested in expanding your media toolbox, you can go to citr.ca to learn more. So the documentary you're about to hear is from Sydney Soldan. It's called Activists of Academia. Sydney just graduated with a poli-sci degree and was particularly interested in manifestations of feminist activism. Specifically, in this documentary, she examines why there seems to be this inertia against activism on the UBC campus that has, rightfully or wrongfully, earned the campus a bit of a reputation as apathetic. So as a part of that, Sydney got a chance to work closely with Eleanor Waring, CITR's volunteer coordinator who released the award-nominated Waiting for Godiva last year, about similar gaps in the conversation around sexual violence on campus. So, if you want to check out Waiting for Godiva, you can also find it on CITR Docs at Stitcher, iTunes, just check back in our archives. For Activists of Academia, stay tuned.
Universities have always been known to be a hotspot for protest among students. From the anti-Vietnam War movement to the recent tuition protests on campuses across North America and countless others, students know that in order to make a change, they need to make their voices heard. UBC has also seen its fair share of activism in its century-long history. However, its relationship is pretty fickle. In 2013, six stranger-in-the-dark sexual assaults occurred on campus over the span of just a couple months. There was an inescapable feeling of unease on campus. Students felt unsafe and unprotected at their own university, and in response, feminist activist groups fought back. 3 years later, in 2016, UBC saw yet another spike of violent sexual assaults. But unlike in 2013, activism was much quieter. What happened? Was there actually less activism taking place? Or was it just more hidden from the public eye than it had been in the past? There is clearly a cycle of rape culture at UBC that is yet to be broken, and activism can be a powerful tool in changing this. How have students at UBC affected change throughout the years with their activism, and how does the university respond to the demands of its students? My name is Sydney Soldan, and these are the Activists of Academia. In the fall of 2013, two marches were held on campus by feminist groups with the intention to respond to the fears of the student community and to get a message across to university administration. The first march was Take Back the Night, part of a series of events held by communities all over the world. This one stirred up some controversy, but we'll get back to that later. The March to Reclaim Consent was the second march on campus in the fall of 2013, organized entirely by students. Laura Fukumoto was one of the organizers of this event. She speaks about the atmosphere on campus prior to the attacks.
So it was the fall of 2013. It was my final semester at UBC. And first of all, right at the beginning of the year, Sauter had been sort of nationally exposed for rape chants. Somebody had like posted something to Twitter, and then something similar had happened at a university in Nova Scotia. So the CBC and Global News, they all sort of like jumped on this story. And on campus, everyone was sort of responding to that at first. And then very shortly after all of that media storm, there was a stranger in the dark sexual assault on campus. And very close after that, at one point in mid-October, it felt like once every weekend, we were hearing reports from the university. And right at this exact same time, a pretty thick fog had rolled through campus and stayed for like 2 weeks solid. So you couldn't see anybody 10 feet away. It was such an odd atmosphere because campus was so creepy and everyone was on edge. And for me personally, this, like the topic of sexual assault on campus, feminism, discussing like body issues, body positivity, that was something that I had sort of low key done throughout my degree. Suddenly, literally everybody was talking about what is it like to be a woman on campus? And this is something that I, like a lot of us, you know, a smaller group of us have been talking about for our entire lives, it felt like.
Those Sauter rape chants that Laura mentioned are just one of many indicators that rape culture still exists on campus and has for a very long time. Laura told me more about this history.
In my experience doing the March to Reclaim Consent and participating in Take Back the Night, I heard other people speak who had were alumni of UBC, and they said, in my day, in 1970, whatever, like there was a series of sexual assaults that happened just like this, and the UBC covered it, and there was discussion, and they told us not to walk alone at night. This person's mother had also gone to UBC. This person's grandmother had also gone to UBC, and there were always stories. Like, as a person who moved here, the first thing that was told to me was, don't walk alone in forests on this campus, have this long history. And nobody knows that really coming here. We only know that from what we tell each other secretly, like what we tell each other, right? Or thank God that somebody's like, we have the internet now to like listen and broadcast, because women have been speaking the whole time. Just nobody's been listening.
Noticing a pattern? This fickle relationship with activism that I alluded to earlier seems to be most prominent in the wake of a tragic or controversial event. And then things quiet down and activism stays out of the spotlight for a couple years, until the next attack or controversy. The cycle just keeps repeating itself over and over again, and the root of the problem is never actually solved. Alex Murky was another student who was not shy about voicing her opinion. During her undergrad as a political science major, she co-founded the Talon, UBC's left-wing activist alternative to other, more traditional UBC press. She recalls her experience while getting involved with activism at UBC and explained more to me about this cycle.
I thought about this a lot when I was on campus because, I mean, I hadn't really heard anything about the history of campus activism until I got involved in like local politics, and I ended up meeting some people who had been involved at UBC, and I found out that they did all this really interesting stuff that I had never heard about. And so I think it's super easy to go through your 4 years or however many years at UBC and just think that there's just no activism going on whatsoever, and that there never has been, because for whatever reason, there's not really a culture of people thinking about the campus in that way.
So what exactly does UBC's activist culture look like? And are most students even aware that this culture exists on their campus?
Like, in terms of activism on campus, UBC kind of tends to go through periods of intense activism and then sort of lulls where there's no one really organizing. Or that's not fair. I mean, like, there will be groups organizing, but in some cases there isn't like a very active or visible like activist presence on campus. So I would say that before the attacks and the marches, we were probably in one of those lulls at UBC where most people wouldn't have been super aware of the types of things that organizing groups are trying to do. There wasn't that much outreach. So there's sort of a disjointed atmosphere. Although simultaneously, I'm Indy Keith, who I referred you to. She had run this event, I think, the previous year called UBC News Feminism. It was part of this broader series of like photo events on campuses where people would take pictures with a sign that said, I need feminism because of, or UBC needs feminism because of X. So she had run that, and then after that she started a Facebook group to sort of like keep the momentum going. And I was part of that, and that was kind of, I mean, the first experience I had with feminism on campus was participating in this Facebook group that actually got quite big and popular. But I think a lot of us also heard about the attacks, like when they happened through that Facebook group, it was sort of, it became sort of a space where a lot of people were communicating about politics, especially people, and I mean, people at very different stages in their political development as well. But yeah, so I think in general, I would describe the like sort of activist climate before the marches and the attacks as fragmented and not really pulling in that much attention.
As Alex mentioned, UBC Needs Feminism was another feminist group that gained a lot of popularity in the wake of the 2013 attacks. This Facebook group provided a safe space for people to discuss issues online that weren't openly being discussed on campus. Like Alex, it also exposed many students to activism for the first time. Indy Keith was the organizer of this group. She talks about how she became involved and how this community developed into something so influential.
It started out as an event I believe we hosted spring of my freshman year at UBC in 2013. And after our page sort of blew up, I think we got on the front page of the Men's Rights Reddit for a time, which made things really interesting in the run-up to the event. But the sort of community developed there, and it was something that I could tell people had been maybe looking for a place for that kind of conversation and weren't finding it, at least at UBC. And so I decided to just sort of roll the comment section of the event into a Facebook group. Didn't really anticipate that it would get as big as it did, but that was sort of how the whole thing started and how it became what it is now.
We want freedom, we want rights. We are taking back the night.
As mentioned earlier, there was another event that contributed to the cycle of feminist activism on campus. Take Back the Night is a nonprofit organization that holds events worldwide, including one that occurred at UBC on October 30th, 2013. Here, students voiced their dissatisfaction with the university's response to the attacks that did not really address the root of the problem that is rape culture on campus. Speaking with activists that attended the event, it seems as though there were mixed feelings towards it. Although the message behind Take Back the Night had good intentions, some attendees felt as though issues concerning intersectionality were not properly addressed, which caused some controversy during the event. Laura gave me her perspective on the event.
Okay, the Take Back the Night march. Ideologically, I think there were some differences. So, I mean, for me, my understanding of Take Back the Night as a march, as a rallying point, that those words, that phrase, is largely centered around women being able to move freely in the night without being blamed for what other people perpetrate against them. But I believe their hearts were in the right place. I think that if we had sat down and talked more about like our beliefs about like what feminism is and where it's headed, we would have a lot to disagree about. It's just like sort of, I'd heard it repeated and it was well understood that they as an organization are not trans inclusive. Somebody responded, I don't know who, but we were all standing around and it was like really dark and really rainy. And somebody said, go get your own march. And so at that point, I was like, this is messy. And so a lot of people left after that point because of that. And it put a really bad taste in my mouth. And that is not the kind of space that I wanted to create. It became apparent at that point that like there needed to be something else as well as that, especially because there doesn't just need to be like one moment.
As Laura said, this is an ongoing conversation that we can learn and grow from, not just one event here and there. The challenges brought up at Take Back the Night helped shape other feminist groups, UBC Needs Feminism and the March to Reclaim Consent included. I spoke more with Indy about how this happened.
I personally wasn't involved with Take Back the Night, and I know there was some criticism of that event because, I mean, the national and international sort of umbrella of Take Back the Night has had some issues with racism and transphobia and just sort of being very white feministy in many places. It's definitely not true for every such event, but there had been some issues and like a history of exclusion at those events that some folks were uncomfortable with. And I think a lot of the impetus for creating the March to Reclaim Consent was to sort of address those intersectionality concerns that many people had with Take Back the Night, and also to make something that specifically addressed the context of UBC and the recent attacks that had happened, and also the fact that our activism and our marches were taking place in a very specific place, which is on unceded territory. And a lot of the dialogue that happened in the Facebook group sort of created the ideas and principles and motivations that shaped the March to Reclaim Consent more than Take Back the Night, which is a larger but less, I think, intentionally shaped event. It was just sort of a direct response to the attacks and the fear and anger a lot of people were having.
While many groups have been created and many protests have been held throughout UBC's history, there seems to be a problem with longevity. Perhaps it's the lack of resources UBC gives these groups, or perhaps it's just the general disinterest that seems to pervade the student body. Whatever the reason, it has created a cycle that is difficult to break. In 2016, another string of sexual assaults occurred on UBC's campus, repeating history yet again. The same fears and angers were brought up, but nothing has changed. And as Laura said earlier, alumni of UBC dealt with the same problems generations ago. So what does all of this mean for the future of campus activism at UBC?
I think part of what is keeping this in like the cycle is a lot of the biggest and most impactful student activist movements have never been institutionalized. So we've got this very large group in UBC Needs Feminism, but it's not officially attached to the university in any way. We don't receive funding. We don't have a meeting space that's for us. We don't have necessarily the resources that an official club might. And if you don't have that official institutionalized structure for handing over control and keeping the ball rolling, sometimes you can just lose that momentum. It can be really difficult to sustain that momentum when there's no buy-in from the people who actually have the power to change it. I mean, I don't know that we can say that no department or no representative of the university is helping. On the whole, the institution is not doing its due diligence when it comes to protecting and serving the marginalized people that feminist activist groups and communities are rising up to protect. I don't think there's many universities that are. I think as both an institution and a student community, my experience was that UBC had a very small core group of people who cared a lot and did a lot and really tried to push the administration and push their peers to do better. But I think more than anything, what I saw on an institutional level and from a large portion of the student body was apathy and just believing, you know, if it wasn't the worst there was, then it wasn't worth doing anything about. So I think the university could absolutely be doing more.
But all hope is not lost, and there are signs that UBC is taking a step in the right direction. For instance, Ashley Bentley was promoted to a new role as Sexual Assault Intervention and Prevention Advisor. And as of April 13th, 2017, UBC approved its first standalone sexual assault policy, which will hopefully eliminate unnecessary delays in reporting assaults and bring more cases to justice. But there is still a long way to go. The 2017 AMS presidential election reiterates the general lack of knowledge on UBC's sexual assault policy and the way administration addressed multiple instances of sexual misconduct by a PhD student in the history department shows that sexual assault is still frequently covered up by the university. We are headed in the right direction, but more needs to change. As cliche as it is, everyone can make a difference. Despite the challenges it is sometimes faced with, activism does and has made a difference. And these student activists are living proof that students have a lot more power to create change than they may think.
That was Activists of Academia. Thank you to Sydney Soldan for that piece. If you're listening to this, you're probably already aware of our Stitcher and iTunes pages, CITR Docs. Just look us up. If you subscribe, you're going to be able to get the documentaries we're releasing bi-weekly until the 19th of June delivered directly to you. You can also go to citr.ca/docs to be redirected to places where you can listen to the docs, or alternatively, find profiles and synopses of the docs that we have presented thus far. Thank you again to Sydney for that piece. Thank you to CRFC Radio Meters for partial funding for this project. Thank you to Poddington Bear for the wonderful bit of music that opens the CITR Docs Season 2 series. Really gives it a bit more of class and elevation. You can find out more about them at poddingtonbear.com. On Wednesday, we're going to have another piece. This one's from Maham Kamal. Stay tuned for a snippet.
And then more broadly, we work with students around cultural transitions. So we often will talk with students who will wonder, my professor's looking at me funny, is that Canadian? Or my roommate is treating me in a certain way, is that Canadian? Or I'm having trouble making friends. What is it about the way people make friends in Canada that's baffling to you? How can we find a way to navigate it, this new place, this new culture? And of course, then the students are able to get their services and supports from anywhere on campus. If a student has an academic advising question, they can go to their academic advisor. If a student has a health issue, they can certainly go to student health. If they want to talk to somebody about mental health concerns, they can go to the wellness center. They can go to counseling, speakeasy. But when they want to talk about things that are specific to being an international student, our office is a great place to start.